Welcome to Turn a Page, the official comic book club for Nerd Initiative. Each week, the NI Bullpen will be covering the world of comics, talking to creators, deep diving into some fantastic stories, and much more. Now let's hand it over to the team and turn a page.
Welcome to a very special edition of Turn a Page, the comic book club on Nerd Initiative. My name is Ken M. I'm the host of the ODPH podcast. I'm also Nerd Initiative's comics editor-in-chief. Also joining us for the special occasion is assistant editors Matt Roth from Hops Geeks News and Marty Stoked. And because it's in his contract, he has to do his own intro.
I'm an agile live and direct straight from the folding chair in the ODPH studios just to make Jeff John smile. My name is Off the Cuff Tom, Nerd Initiative's pop culture connoisseur. Matt, Marty, Gary, Brian, Jason, Ken, and Jeff. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Always a pleasure, guy. I always loved those. That intro is such a great intro.
you get the sense that they've done it before.
Yeah, I know. I love it. It's great. Just to be clear. It does make me smile. Thank you.
Yes. And talk about making people smile. There is going to be two special days coming up in the calendar year. First and foremost is April 3rd, which if you are not familiar with, comic fans, you need to have circled on your calendars, set the alarms, set the reminders, do whatever you need to, because there is three major books that are dropping that you absolutely have to have in your collection. There is no excuse for you not to pick these books up. But more importantly, March 11th is the final order cutoff date. So you need to make sure you run as soon as you hear this episode to the comic shop, sign up. Make sure you have your copies, plural. You're going to need more than one because this is going to be a whole new wave of comics that is going to take over, and you don't want to be the one missing out. So luckily, we have the creators of these lines of books coming on the show, and you know their work from such past stuff as Three Jokers, Batman Year or 3-1, The Ultimates, but let's face it, that's the past. The future is summed up in two words, Ghost Machine. So joining us for the special edition, you know him as the artist of Redcoat, Ryan Hitch, the artist of Rook Exodus, Jason Fabok, the artist of Geiger, Gary Frank, and the writer of all three of these books, Jeff Johns. Gentlemen, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us. Good to see you guys.
It's good to see you too. Yeah, so let's get into it. Obviously, the last time we talked to you was right before the one-shot came out in January. Since that time, obviously, we're getting closer and closer to Ghost Machine Day, April 3rd. For everybody, how has the journey been since that point came out? What's the emotions going into that big day?
Let's make Brian start.
What was the question again?
Let's see if he can talk without a glass of wine in it.
Yeah. No, I'm feeling jittery already.
Yeah.
No. It's odd for us, I suppose, because we've been putting Ghost Machine together in one form or another. It wasn't Ghost Machine then for almost 2 years. So to get to the point where, you know, and Gary and Jeff have done Geiger already in a couple of forms. They did the originals, you know, the trades out, and there was the Ground Zero just at the end of last year. So they've had a good run up to this. But I suspect for Jay and I, this is, you know, something really special because it's the first time our books. I mean, Jay's book is actually even newer than mine because I suppose I did the preview story for Red Coat in the Geiger 80-page Giant 2 years ago. So again, it's been quite a long run up. So it's just really great to have stuff that's going to be out there that people can pick up and read and respond to. For us, you know, we're obviously quite a bit further down the line in our plans and our production. But it's always exciting when something you're so genuinely proud of comes out. And we are also proud of these books and each other's work as well. So it's really exciting. In fact, it's the most excited I've been since I did Ultimates.
Wow.
Yeah, it's for all of us, and I'll speak for me, and the other guys can speak for themselves. It's been a long journey, but it's also, it kind of came together so organically, like we talked about last time. But to have the books, like, they're all going to the printer, like, next week, the print runs are set, and the books are great. Like, they all are beautiful. They're all very different. You know, there's a lot of conversation about, should we put them all out on the same day? And ultimately it was like, yes, because it shows you kind of the diversity of titles. Like Redcoat in tone is very different than Rook and Geiger, but the books all feel very much like our work. Like, you won't read one of those books, and I think when you read Redcoat, it feels like something that Brian and I would do. And Geiger is the same thing with Gary and I, and Jay with Rook Exodus, and yet all the books too are part of the same initiative. And because we we literally own all this stuff together, like all of it. And we're all in it together on every level. And it's our company and our books. And there's a sense, there's a real big sense of pride, because this isn't, doesn't just feel like launching a new title. It feels like, and we are, we're launching our company, our who we are as people. Like, this is who we are. Our work is who we are. So when you see these books, this is who we are. And I'm really proud of who we are and what we've done and what we've built and everybody that's a part of this. So for me, it goes so far beyond the professional, you know, aspect of like, oh, it's exciting to have a new book out, especially from Image like this, because it's such a dream to be at Image. It's just so personally, it's a symbol of like what all of us together have been working towards. And that's really exciting to have it finally kind of come out. The one shot was one thing, but you know, you're getting 6 pages or 10 pages. 4 pages of a character. It's just a taste. And this, like, you know, Rook and Redcoat are twice the size. They're big intros. And Geiger is, I think, a nice, great continuation, but also an introduction, if you haven't read Geiger, to the book. And that's what I'm excited about, is people experiencing these, you know, what we put our everything we have into. But it's all on the page.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that just really jumps out about that. I mean, Jason, especially too, is like, this is one of your first books as well. Like I say, the emotions coming in with now being creator owned, like, how is this affecting with you?
Yeah, I mean, I remember being very, right now I'm feeling very excited. Like I've been waiting for this day, because we've been working on Rook for a while. Like, I drew the first issue, maybe it was sometime last year, early last year. We even started it the year before, and we slowly kind of worked on it. And then we went back and we changed things. And you know, because we were working ahead, and it's like, let's add some stuff. Let's flesh this out a little more. We've got it to a point where, like, I'm really, really proud of it. And so I'm excited. Like, I'm anxious. I want it to get out there, because I want people to read it and dive into it. And it's the same feeling I kind of had when Three Jokers was ready to come out, because we had worked on that for so long too. And it's like, you just want to unleash it out there and let people read it and enjoy it. And so I'm really excited. I can't wait. I can't wait for April 3rd to come, but at the same time, I got to do a lot of work. So I don't want it to come too quickly.
No, completely understandable there.
Yeah.
And then for Gary, I mean, obviously Geiger was one of the first character to come out from Ghost Machine, and now being arguably the flagship character of the first wave to come out, like, how is it feeling for you to reintroduce that character to a whole new audience?
It's kind of, I don't have the butterflies, I guess. I don't have the because, you know, we've done it. We've already had Geiger out there and everything, and it went down well. We're really, really pleased. So for us, it's kind of, I'm speaking for both of us, Jeff, but I think for now we kind of feel quite at home with this work, right? It feels like we're in a groove. We know where we're going with it. We know what we're doing with it. And it's kind of, you know, it's just nice. We've talked a little bit about how the fact that we've done so much kind of feels like, and the fact that you're returning, it feels like there's not so much world building involved. I don't know if that necessarily reflects in any way on you know, how we feel about the launch of the miniseries, but it does definitely feel like a continuation of something, which I guess it is.
Yeah, it feels very lived in. I think the interesting thing about, like, Geiger, like, we're on like our 12th issue now of Geiger, and including everything, and it feels really comfortable. Like, I love the characters. There's new supporting cast member that joins up in issue one, and it feels to me, it feels like the classic comics I love. I mentioned the original Vertigo line a lot, like Preacher and Shade the Changing Man and Animal Man, and like that had an influence on kind of for me in each one of these. They're so totally different, but they're just classic character-driven stories that are a little bit off the beaten path. They're not quite superheroes. Like, they're almost all superhero adjacent, but we didn't want to do straight capes and tights. And Geiger has a very kind of gritty feel, but it's still a lot. There's a lot of emotion in Geiger. There's a lot of, like, Geiger is kind of this guy that's caught between being a really violent, you know, force of nature as a glowing man, but then also a very caring and kind husband and father as Tariq Geiger. And that push-pull is evident, I think, in every issue. You see these moments of real warmth from him, and then you see these moments of brutality and that kind of, you know, protective nature. Like, his story really is, like, you know, protection is, it's being a father isn't all about protection, which he, I think, misunderstood. And it's about a lot more, and being a your role in life can change, and, you know, what you're meant for can change. And And that man versus the monster is kind of a classic trope. I think Gary and I both love.
Yeah.
And that's really what Geiger's all about. It's this guy's got to find purpose, and you know. But it's really fun to watch him meet people we really don't like that deserve to be beat to hell, and he does it. You know, like that's fun.
There's that catharsis and everything there. But I also like the fact that, I mean, aside from him being protective and that being his role as the protector of the family, I like exploring the degree to which he kind of he's dependent on the family, or he's dependent how his personality to stay grounded. He requires somebody to care about. It's just a nice thing. He's not just kind of a raging lunatic who's pissed off because he's lost everything. He's kind of there's an element of this kind of struggle to find himself again, or find what it was about himself that was drawn from his role as a father.
Yep.
So yeah, nice. It's nice and complex, and it's nice and human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it definitely jumps off the page too, and I think that's also a credit to two other creators that are involved in all three of your books, and that's Brad Anderson and Rob Lay. So talk about their impact on your books coming out.
Well, I'm just going to nip in here because these guys had worked with Brad before, and apart from a couple of covers Brad did as warm-ups before we started working on Ghost Machine stuff, I'd not really worked with Brad before. I liked his work, but never worked with him before. So it's been kind of a real process of discovery of just how really bloody good he actually is. And just what he brings to it. And, you know, there's such a joy when he turns the pages in, because the way he thinks and the way he works, it's always an enhancement. And the same with Rob, you know, apart from how good a physical letterer he is, it's just he knows placement really well. You don't have to try and control that. He just understands where to put it in the artwork. And now I've got him contributing, because of the period setting, there's all these different kind of places, signposts, and if you look at like Victorian or, you know, 19th century cities where Simon's hanging out, there's an awful lot of you know, billboards, because they advertise what the shops are, what they sold, before there was kind of the advertising that we're familiar with. So I've just started asking Rob to do all that stuff, because it just looks much, much better when he does it than when I do it. So again, that's an enhancement to the artwork. So there's you know, they're both part of the art team. You can't just say they're colorists and letterers. They're part of the art team.
Yeah, they're massive creators. I mean, Brad, we call him the master of light, or I call him the master of light, because he can make anything light up off the page, including Geiger. I don't know how he makes Geiger look like he's glowing during the day, but he does. The process to it that he is some kind of trade secret. He won't tell me what it is, but he's just phenomenal. And you can see all these books when you look at them. Each one has a different palette. I love that Geiger's got this like yellow green look, and you know, Red Coat's obviously got the red, and Rogue's got this yellow palette to it. But Brad's so enthusiastic about the books, and Rob doesn't just letter the books, like Ryan says, he does placement, sound effects for the books, and also he really dives into story. Like, he's not just lettering, he's into it, and he always has notes in the columns that make sense. Like, hey, what about this? What about, like, he's thinking about it, and that's appreciated so much, because it's truly additive to the book, and that's what these guys do. Brad and Rob add to the book; they make the books better and better. And you know, that's what you hope for when you're working with creative people. But and also, Brad and Rob go well beyond colorist and letterer. They're part of the company. They're really important to the culture of the company, and who we are and what we do and how we do it, and you know, all their experience in different things. Like, Rob's worked for toy manufacturers, and I mean, all that kind of comes into play. And they're, when we're together, I mean, you won't find someone else that's, you know, at the pool more at the hotels than Brad Anderson with a drink. We're actually, the whole company's on like a Signal chat, and it's really fun to just, you know, Brad and Rob are two of like 20 of us, that it's really fun to just be on Signal with people across the world talking about sometimes our comics and our company, and sometimes just, hey, it's snowing today, look what I got to deal with. And it's really funny.
That you can't blame Brad for being in the pool all the time, when you see what the fact that virtually every day there's a picture of him shoveling snow off the driveway. Yeah. No wonder he likes a swimming pool when he gets access to it.
He's got one in his back garden, actually.
You never see it, though, will he?
It's that camaraderie. It's really that camaraderie and that personal connection and conversation that continues beyond, you know, our work. And that to me is what makes this company so special, and why the books are really good, because everyone cares so much about him. It's not just a paycheck.
It's what we said yesterday, wasn't it? We all came for the creative opportunities and the business opportunities that something like this represented, but there's no doubt we're staying because of the people we've connected with.
Yeah, for sure. It's like I feel so protective of this group because everybody's so damn good and everybody's such a great person. Like you're like, oh my gosh, this is like a perfect, it's a perfect storm of creative and, you know, personal and professional people.
It gives you kind of the fact that we're all kind of like that and we've all got this kind of group together. It also makes you kind of feel a sense of responsibility in terms of the work, in that you know that you're not just working for yourself and to make sure that you get another freelance gig. It's the fact that you know that everybody is kind of, everybody's interdependent. Everybody needs everybody else to be doing well. So kind of it gives you this feeling of kind of you know, you need to pull your weight and you need to do your best stuff and you need to do it on time because everybody's dependent on you.
Yeah, there's a sense of pride to it all.
Well, there's no competition, is there? Because I mean, there's it's the kind of competition that comes from being inspired by the people you work with, and you want to be as good as them and work as hard as them. But you know, we're all just so into each other's stuff and interested in each other's work and the stuff that we've got coming up from others, like Pete and Francis and Pete and Peter and Maytal and Lamont, stuff as that's developing. And you know, it's not just you anymore, and it's not just you and this job. We talked before about how, I mean, having three books launched on the same day, you know, in our freelance world, you all want your book to be number one because it's important for you to have this personal level of success. But that's not what it's like here, because we all own Ghost Machine, and Ghost Machine owns all the IPs and all the books, and all the profits are shared in that way. You know, that takes away that level of competition. You want to be good, but you want everybody to succeed. And it doesn't matter which of us is, you know, selling the most books at the end of the day, because it's we're just not looking at it like that. There are bottom lines for the company to think about in terms of the numbers you need to shift. But, you know, I'd be just as delighted if, you know, Hornsby and Halo was the biggest seller that Ghost Machine has all year. We're just as excited about that. But we're all invested in each what we're doing, and this is long-term commitments for all of us. None of these books are going away.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say, I hope they don't go away, because, I mean, with the three that you have launching this on April 3rd, we can't stress enough, it's Ghost Machine Day, and it's going to be such a monumental day at the shops. I mean, let's kind of dive into a little bit. And first and foremost, I know Matt has been itching to talk about Redcoat, so I'll hand it over to him, because obviously the description of him being the immortal mercenary who's a bit of a tool, I mean, that is an amazing selling point. But Matt, I mean, I know you want to talk about this.
Yeah, no, this is probably my most anticipated, just because I have such a love for history. And
tools.
Just, yeah. He said it. I sympathize with him a little bit, right? Like, just a little goofiness. But so I know Brian touched upon this in Orlando, being this outside perspective, you know, coming up with the character Simon, who is British and going through American history. What was that like for you and Jeff to kind of have these opposing, I guess, growing up, you learned one thing, Jeff definitely learned more, a different side of the American history. What was that like blending together to create this magical fantasy that just travels through time?
Well, the weird thing is, I suppose, is that culturally, we're actually extremely similar, because the culture I grew up on, I mean, I might have grown up in England, the far north of England, where culture was few and far between anyway, but it was all American stuff, you know, from whether it was Cagney and Lacey or Superman the movie, it was American pop culture that I absorbed. It was American music I listened to. American comics, absolutely. It was all American. So, you know, when my sister and I used to talk when we were kids that we just wanted to go and live in America, because it was so much, obviously, this is 1970s America, so perhaps it wasn't the best place to be, but... But yeah, so we have the same culture. We're the same age. We have pretty much the same kind of pop cultural background. You know, we both adored Superman the movie. Jeff worked for Dick Donner, so he's got an even bigger connection to that material. And you see, there's more similarities between us than there are differences, I think. We've had different lives, certainly, but I don't think the cultural differences are there, but we do bring different sensibilities, because when it comes down to it, Jeff's American and I'm English, and Simon's an Englishman in America, so there's always a personal perspective to that. I don't know how we got onto it being an Englishman, you know, a British soldier in It just sort of came out almost by osmosis, really.
It was almost like, who's the most undeserving human being to become immortal? And it was like, well, maybe
obviously he was an Englishman, right? Englishman. Yeah.
An English redcoat soldier, right? and then we had to be like, it really did start with that. It's like, who's the most undeserving person to gain immortality that would just absolutely waste it? And like, and he's not, it's funny because we were talking about Simon, as we do all the time. It's like, he's not cynical. He's not really cynical. He's just kind of like, that's the way things go. Like, he's aloof.
Yeah.
He's a little aloof. He's a little like, he's.
Well, everything's face value with Simon. There's no real subterfuge in that regard. He's, you know, when people show themselves to be assholes, he believes them. There's no kind of. Second guessing that.
Yeah. It's a really. I really can't wait for you and everybody else to meet Simon in full, because I think, like, by the time you see him running, you know, he deserts the Battle of Trenton, and by the time you see him desert it and hide from the colonists, you already kind of get a sense of who he is. But this first issue paints a picture of a man who just, he grew up with a feeling worthless, and he still does, but it doesn't really bother him. You know, like, it doesn't really, it just kind of is who he is. And
it's that face value again, isn't it? Yeah. Because, you know, he's been told he's worthless, so he accepts that he's worthless. So,
okay. And he's also just, but he doesn't seem to bother him. And he'd rather talk his way out of things or run away from things than solve anything. And he's done that for 116 years since he's been immortal, when we meet him in 1892. But it's fun too, because there's a little dash of like greatest American hero in there, because he thinks he's immortal and that's it, but there's a lot more to it. And he just is kind of, you know, at times an idiot, so he doesn't really know or even care to explore much of what happened to him. He just knows that he gets killed and he wakes back up about 24 hours later. And there's a few things like about being immortal, like you're always a little hungry. Like, no matter how much he eats, he's always just a little hungry, and it's super annoying. And he's always broke because he's terrible with money. He thinks it's a curse. He's like, I must just be like, that's the curse. But he's just terrible with money.
And people. Yeah.
Yeah. He's awful with people. He has terrible relationships. He makes a lot of enemies, causes a lot of damage. By the way, also, he meets a young Albert Einstein who speaks German. And I love that Simon. He's lived 116 years and he hasn't bothered to learn another language. Like, he doesn't really, there was much
of an education system back then either.
No, but self-improvement is not something that Simon really considers.
Mm. Yeah, at least not a very English thing to live 116 years and never bother to learn another language. There's nothing more English than that.
No, that's absolutely true.
Or American, by the way.
That's also true.
Yeah. I mean, you can always spot the Englishman abroad because he's walking around shouting, doesn't anybody speak a bloody word of English around here?
Yeah, it's funny because, and look, you guys can tell by the thing I love about Redcoat so much is there's a great world behind him, a great mythology behind him, but all we talk about is him, his character, who he is, and then when things come his way, how he deals with things, which is often runaway. And that's what makes these books, all three of them, so great, is that they're so built on character. Like, Redcoat is built around, it's Simon Pure's book, it's his story. Everything's from his perspective, his point of view. And it is, so it does have Matt, like, you know, okay, his view of America and how it's run, but it's not necessarily about that. It's not a political book. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's kind of a universal emotional book about, but we just did decide who is the most undeserving human being that could become immortal. And I think
after me, it was Simon. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
does that kind of set us up for, I know everything's kind of at face value with Simon, but are there going to be a bit more emotional aspects and twists and turns that people might not expect from this book then?
Yeah,
that's the journey, isn't it? It's the big emotional journey. Where you take somebody who's this, you know, disregarding, you know, superficial asshole, and you turn him, you know, it might take 350 years, but as we say, the day he becomes that decent human being that suddenly realizes that here's the person that the world needs in that moment, that's the end of the story. And if it takes 100 issues to get to that, or 150 issues, but once we get to that, it's just, that's the story done, because it's the journey for Simon. But, you know, for us, it always takes a lifetime. But Simon's lifetime is essentially, you know, has no end.
Yeah.
So it's just, how long does it take you to learn from your mistakes? For me, you know, it's taken me, you know, I'm 54, and I would say that I probably only really figured shit out now, both personally and professionally. You know,
you're way ahead of Simon, Brian.
Yeah, I know. But that's, you know, but by the time we meet Simon in the 19th century, his if, you know, if we say he's got a 300, 400 year lifespan, he's still pretty much only middle-aged. So, you know, he's only hitting the point that I'm hitting, because I'm obviously going to live to 108.
It's a really unique book, and it's 38 pages too. So
the first issue,
for $3.99, and great, beautiful art by Brian and Brad and Rob. But it's fun. It's just fun because it's so different. I don't know of any other book out there ever that was like Red Coat.
It's definitely a unique story. And that's, you know, 100%. I can't wait. I can't wait for all the books, but as soon as I saw like the lineup initially, Red Coat was the one that jumped out immediately to me. And it's already been ordered at my comic book shop. That much I do know.
Well, that's like, our hope is that all our books appeal to, like, it's just, they're all going to appeal to different people. Some people might like that. Some people might like this. Some people might like all of them, you know, and that's the goal, is to create books for different tones, yeah, for different audiences or the same audience. As long as it's just quality. Like, that's our key thing is Ghost Machine. It just is going to symbolize its quality. It's people who are artists, who great stories, great art, great characters, and different tones, you know?
Yeah, you speak about the quality, which is incredible. And that is the case with all of these books. And it just shows in that big, massive book that you guys put out earlier to tease everything up. The quality of all of the art is unreal. And that alone should get people to jump in, because you guys aren't shortcutting anything. Like, there are times where, you know, some of the panels aren't as detailed, but there's no panel that in any of the books that are out there that don't have the line work, the shading, the detailed aspects that I personally love, you know, about the art around what you guys are producing. And then the characters that you guys are creating are just top notch and unreal.
Thanks.
I mean, so it's incredible.
And so that's our goal is to, honestly, just, we want to have a high level of craft and real personal creation. So every one of these characters is a personal creation, and you'll feel us in those, but we're giving everything we got. You know, we this is the most important thing we've all ever done.
Yeah, it shows. And I mean, for me, you know, Matt, you talked about Red Coat jumping out at you. For me, like, I've known Geiger and I've known Junkyard Joe, and those are automatic pulls because I love them and I want to see where that character goes. And I thought that was an incredible start. But for me, like, when I saw Rook, I was like, wow, like, just the character design alone. And the tease that we got with the six-ish pages in that one shot just gave us tidbits about what this world is really about, but nowhere near enough to where we know where it could be going. And there's so many questions that, like, when I was reading through it, had me intrigued. And it has a whole bunch of different themes that are playing into it with the corporate. You know, you kind of got this post-apocalyptical sense. You got these this really cool tech helmets where you can, you know, have conversations with animals, and there's animal aspect to it, which I loved, and in hyper detail. But for readers that haven't really saw the first six issues, like Jason or Jeff, can you give us a quick introduction to Rook? And then following that, I really want to know the inspiration behind Rook's character design and the backstory, because I feel like it definitely, this is something that hasn't been done before. There are aspects that I've seen, but not melded in the way that you guys are melding it. And I'm really digging it.
Jeff, why don't you lay out the story stuff, because you're great at that, and I'll talk about it.
Oh, gosh. Okay, Jay. Okay. Jay, it all started with the design that Jay had of Rook that he had since he was, how old were you, 13 or something? Like,
I mean, it evolved over years, but
yeah. But Jay, we were talking about, like, what we wanted to do, and Jay eventually, you know, we sent this design, and I said, like, let me take this design and just think about it. And I came, the initial thought was the next day. I called him, and we started talking about, like, our relationship between technology and animals, and, you know, the idea, like, everyone has a favorite animal. Like, it's just, we do, right? We all were kind of grew up, what's your favorite animal? It might change over the years, but we have a favorite animal. And we relate to animals in a certain way. And there's something really cool about doing a world where, okay, if this guy Rook had the ability to kind of control these birds with this helmet, and there were other wardens essentially that have these different helmets that control animal species, and these helmets affect them, and they talked to these animals, and it was all under the pretense of a world where, you know, who doesn't wish that everything was under control here on Earth? Like, who doesn't wish that everything was, like, from the weather? I sure do, from the rain yesterday here, from weather to the to every aspect of nature. And really, the idea was, well, someone tried to do that, and this guy left Earth because he felt he had no control here, and that it was too far gone, and that the problems were much too big for him to solve. Like, they're just, it was overwhelming, which I think all of us can relate to a bit. And went to this other world where everything was supposed to be under control. He was employed by this world. He was a farmer, and now he's there to control the birds. The birds need to be there because scavengers serve a purpose. The purpose won't be to eat their crops, but to be scavengers. And so he did that, and he went under training with other wardens, like Swine, who controls warthogs, one of our favorite characters. He's like Pigpen if he became a superhero, and from Peanuts. And he's got these boars he loves. He loves his drift, his pigs, and the technology broke, and everybody who paid to move to this planet Exodus left. They paid to leave, and the employees were left behind by the corporation, who said, we'll be back, and they never came back. And the world has since devolved into a war over the control of nature. And these wardens are the most prized kind of people that control these animal species. And so Rook, when we meet him, he's just trying to finish building a rocket and leave Exodus. And every like, you know, week or 2 weeks, he sees a rocket fly up into the sky as someone is trying to escape. And more often than not, the rockets detonate and they crash back down to the ground, and he scavenges them with Swine for parts for a rocket he's making so that they can leave. And the themes of this take, you know, there's a lot of themes, the natural instinct of fight or flight that we all have, right? When things are bad, we want to run away. Everyone's had that bad day at work where they're like, I'm just going to quit, right? Or had a bad time, like where their instinct screams, that primal instinct screams to just fly away, just leave. And that's just, we all have that. And the other one is to stand and fight. And that's really within Rook Exodus, what it's all about is, you know, when a world's overwhelmed with problems, what do you do? And then also a relationship with animals and just cool kick-ass action too, with like helmets and animals. And we love Jay and I love 80s cartoons like Thundercats and, you know,
yes,
G.I. Joe and all that. They had such great characters and they were all so unique and fun. So it's got a lot of, you know, a lot of aspects to it, but yeah. And it's about this guy Rook who's a scavenger now. He's like the birds that he controls. He's scavenging for rocket parts to leave and fly away. And that's where the story starts, though it goes somewhere completely different, right, Jay?
Yeah. I think, you know, like there's this, like Jeff was saying, like everybody has their own favorite animal. And, you know, it's something that I think people, they connect with. They connect with the characteristics of animals and how they look and sometimes even just down to their colors, you know. We really want to play that up. At first, when I came up with the design, like I always had this design for this guy with a trench coat and like a bird looking mask. And I was kind of messing around with this idea and kind of like a mix of military and Mad Max and a little bit of Star Wars and all this sort of thing in there. And it was Jeff who had suggested, he's like, well, what if there's other characters with helmets? Like originally I just had a guy and he was just called Rook. And he was kind of like, I just figured he's a character who kind of like a Batman in a sense where he takes on an animal avatar and that's his symbol. And he runs off and he's fighting whatever, battling monsters and stuff like that. But Jeff was the one who was like, what if there's other characters who control animals as well? And then that like totally unlocked everything. And at first, like I was being very subtle with the designs and then now I'm just really leaning into it. So if there's a guy who's like a character who's based off of a fox, I'm really leaning into that. Or like Swine, like I made him like a little heavyweight. He's a little overweight and he's, you know, hairy and, you know, he's probably stinks as well. Like he can kind of smell him his stuff's all dirty. And it's like, we started to kind of play up to the different characteristics because it felt, I remember even having a conversation at one point and we said, is this too cheesy? Like, is the idea of characters with animal helmets controlling
not
it
at all?
No,
absolutely not.
We came out of it going like, no, I think we have to lean into it.
Yes.
Because it's kind of like, it reminds me of things like He-Man, where, you know, you got a character called Fistor and he's just got a giant fist, you know, it's like you just lean, or Skeletor, he's a skeleton, you know? Like you just, you lean into it, you lean into the theme.
Awesome. Every Skunk character. I got it. Yeah, we got it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, by the way, Moss Man was just Beast Man, but green with like that.
Yeah,
yeah. So there was a guy called Fistor.
Fisto.
Brian,
you couldn't get away with that today.
No, I think they changed the name. I grew up on that cartoon, Masters of the Universe, and I loved that cartoon. I loved all the characters, Web Store and all those guys. Like, they were all so crazy, but there are aspects of kind of the, you know, the 80s, I guess a little bit of the 80s cartoon lines, because we those were cool characters. They captivated me, and they the imagination that went into them was a little campy, but it was really fun. And I think we're walking the line of, you know, something that's got real ethos and emotion. That's the most important thing. It's got to be grounded in real emotion with real stakes and real, and we have something to say. We do have something to say with these books. All these books have something to say. Like with Rook, it is, we are talking about, like, you know, the pressures of the world today on an individual, and like our relationship with animals, and then just why do we all relate to an animal? And like, there's a lot of aspects we're exploring, and we have, Jenny and I, we have, like, I don't want to kind of get into like the you know, kind of the conclusion Rook comes to in this first arc, because it is what the book's about. But it's, I think it's really powerful, and it will relate with people. When I was working on Green Lantern, I always loved, like, the mythology is cool. There's all these lanterns and aliens, and these rings work a certain way. The Guardians created them, you charge it, and this is how it works. But it was really the overcoming fear and the emotional aspect of how that power reacted to an individual. It was like the ghost in the machine, where the ghost is like, you can't quantify a ghost, and the machine is very quantifiable, right? It's they're kind of at odds, which is where the phrase ghost in the machine came from. They're complete opposites. One's all passion, one's all structure, and you can't really kind of reverse engineer the passion. And to me, that the emotional aspect of why we connect with animals, and what are, and how we've lost that in a lot of ways, and, you know, how we regain it, and what it means, and why is it important, and all that is, it's really fun to work that into the technology of it, because Rook feels to me most like personification of what Ghost Machine means, as a, where the name at least came from, is the mystery of, you can create technology to control animals, but that relationship between you and the animal, that's a little different. That's not the same thing as just having a program go into an animal's brain and they do whatever you want. It's very complicated. And so that exploring all that, just as us as people and our instinct of fight versus flight, and how do you, when do you lean into flight, when do you lean into fight, why? And we all feel that. So it's fun to just explore all that stuff through, with a kick-ass, like, you know, helmet that looks like a gorilla, and he's controlling his gorilla. You know, that's just cool. And there's giant tanks and rocket ships and, you know, giant guns and a big bear guy that's genetically modified himself to be 10 feet tall. Like, there's cool, like, there's just crazy stuff in there. But all these titles and characters have to be grounded in real emotion. And we got to say something. We want to say and explore something that everyone can relate to and connect with, and at the same time have a lot of fun with it, have kick-ass action and visuals and characters. And and that's what Rook is. Rook's really, I think it's both a very simple idea and a very complicated idea at the same time.
Now, you were talking about animal companions. One big thing for me is, and everybody in the bullpen knows, as soon as you throw in a creature or a sidekick or anything, you got me hooked on a book.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to flip it, though, to another book. Where did Barney come from? Like, I read the 80 page, don't get me wrong, but where did the name Barney come from? That is like the most important question of this whole thing that's going on. This is why I'm sitting here today.
Barney was a name that came out of a lot of conversations
can we say what the first name was that we first came up with?
Yes.
We were originally going to call him Brian, but we changed, but we ultimately,
after, not you, Brian Cunningham was Brian the inspiration.
We ultimately changed it to Barney. And here's the thing about a name like Barney. Barney's a, like, it's just a very, like, I knew a dog named Barney. Barney was a really kind dog, a fun dog. And, And it's a loving name for an animal. And so that dog kind of inspired the name. And Barney is, you know, an example of Barney is a big character in our book, a really big character, particularly in the first arc. We're even going to have an issue that's just Barney too, coming out a little bit later.
Oh, let's go. Yes.
Yeah. We a two-headed dog. He'll meet other mutant animals that he befriends. But it's going to be awesome. We love animals in Ghost Machine, so there are a lot of animal characters. They exist in all, like a lot of our books. Pranky, the world's worst Boy Scout in High Street, has a dog. But there's Barney was designed to be a warm addition to Geiger's cast, and you can see that in that 10-page story. For those who don't know, like Geiger, he reads. He loves libraries. It's the only place scavengers don't raid because nobody wants books. Like
that was a really hard panel for me to see the whole library just lit up like that. That was knowing the character now.
And there's a little bit of a nod to that great Twilight Zone episode, if you guys remember, with Burgess Meredith, who like just wanted to read, you know, and that were all the time to read books. And Geiger passes the time by reading books, and he finds this, you know, this, he sees this, these dogs in this library, including the little mutant puppy Barney, who's a little like barking at him, like yapping at him. He's like, okay, whatever. And Geiger's pretty closed off. And when they're attacked and an accident happens and the dogs all are killed by this creature, and the only one surviving is this little two-headed puppy. And Geiger can't help but take him in. It says a lot about who Geiger is.
Now, speaking of Geiger, with the production, how that's been since, you know, Geiger is technically the granddaddy of the Ghost in the Machine. You know, you've done three, you've done volume one, we've done Ground Zero, we've done the 80 page, and we know we've got stuff coming out. With the gaps in between, did you write all the scripts all at once, or what was it like getting back into that mindset to write Geiger and to draw Geiger as well?
Well, Gary and I, you know, we went from Geiger to Junkyard Joe, and Junkyard Joe was a very, very different book. And that's something that when we first started to expand the unnamed universe, the timeline, I was so excited about the idea of a Junkyard Joe story. And Gary and I talked about it, and it was just so different. Because I remember, Gary, you were kind of like, I've drawn the nuclear wasteland. Like, he wanted to shake it up, and we went to the jungles of Vietnam in 1972. And I remember by the end of that issue, you're like, okay, I'm ready to get out of the jungles.
Yeah. Well, I think it made sense also to have that contrast within the story. So the first issue kind of opens up and it's that steamy kind of oppressive jungle. And then we go to kind of like a winter in Indiana. So there's just kind of these vast fields of snow and everything. So it was nice to kind of have that character and take him out of one scenario and put him in the other. But yeah, it's good. I mean, it kind of emphasized the contrast. The thing with Junkyard Joe is that he was a thing made for a particular task in a particular environment. And then the whole story is kind of about what does he do though when he comes home? How does he find a way to fit into a completely different environment? You know, he comes home and he doesn't have a family, and that was kind of, you know, exploring all of that. And he's still dealing with, I mean, he's a robot, but he's kind of been traumatized by what happened, and he's coming back and he just needs somebody to help him deal with it. And he comes home and finds himself alone. So that bleakness and the environment, it just kind of all played into that. So it all made a nice contrast.
I love the contrast. It's funny because the only it's partially why Redcoat and Rook are double sized issues. I wish we had, when we did Junkyard Joe 1, if what issue 1 and 2 had been one double sized issue, because you would have had that great contrast between the jungle and then today. It reads great in the trade, but it's funny, when we did this special edition of Junkyard Joe 1 for the cons, we actually put issue 1 and 2 together in the special edition, because it really tells you the story. You really know what the story is. You know, that chapter in the jungle is its own story, but that next chapter, when we cut to the vet, the Vietnam vet he saved, you know, yeah, that's the one. Nice, you got it. That's the one. That tells you kind of everything. But I love that book. It was so fun to write Junkyard Joe because it was such a different type of book. It was more like a Spielberg Amblin movie than it was like a, you know, like a Mad Max, you know, film like Geiger. It just felt so different. And having it taking place in a small town in Indiana, Melody Hills, Indiana, with the family next door and kids. And I love those kids. It reminded me a little, it had a dash of like what Gary and I did in Shazam, in that first Shazam story. I love like having, you know, like Will, this little kid, this little punk boy kid in there is just to me, is the funniest kid. But having all kids in there with a robot and this 76-year-old Vietnam vet, like it was a cool, different type of cast than I think Gary, you and I have ever done. And you don't usually see that in books, you know, and there wasn't anything about vets. Like, we haven't seen a lot of stories that explore what it's like to be a vet coming home. And that's what the story was exploring.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic story. So I know we're coming near on time, but before you guys go, obviously, Rook Exodus, Red Coat, and Geiger, all three issues are number one issues dropping on April 3rd. My question for everybody here is, what was your favorite number one issue as a fan? And did that influence anything going in with these issues?
Do you mean of all time? Like a favorite number one issue of a comic of
yep.
all time? Oh, wow.
No pressure.
I don't know if I ever read too many number ones because, I mean, kind of growing up in the 70s, Brian will probably attest to this. We kind of got American comics. We didn't really get them in any particular order. We were lucky we could get them. They would just kind of arrive in the newsagents. This story's probably been told a few times, but they were basically used for ballast on ships coming back from transporting stuff to America. So they would just end up randomly in newsagents.
5 months out of date, yeah.
Yeah. When I would go to visit my grandmother, there was a newsagent that had American comics near her. So I would just kind of go up and rummage through the pile and hope there was something new and then pick out the stuff. Like 6 months later, I might still be rummaging through the same pile and gradually getting down to the comics I wasn't particularly interested in at first, but just getting desperate. And then every so often you'd kind of go in and there would be all of I used to really, for me, the treasure was a Marvel team up. If I could find a Marvel team up, that would be great.
Okay.
But so in terms of number ones, I didn't really know, to be honest. I kind of sort of more.
Sounds like we need to have you back for another interview.
Actually, growing up as a kid, so in the mid 80s, what was I, 15? That's when Byrne did Man of Steel. Mm. And I got those number ones. And I just, the excitement around Superman getting a relaunch, a rebirth, and a rejig. And it was so new then, this whole idea of reboots and rebirths. And that had followed on from Crisis, which I'd got as well. So, as a kid who grew up only on DC Comics, because that's all we got, all they could get, those two things were a huge event for me. And Touchstones too, because Superman was my favorite character and the guy who got me into comics in the first place. So, I don't think I was trying to channel that, but we talk about this with influences and things that have influenced us is that, often when you think about, I'm trying to do a thing just like, say, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez did in one of his comics, and you go back and look at it later and it's nothing like what you remembered. What you're really trying to capture is how something made you feel at the time you saw it. So that kind of features heavily in work is the things that inspired you and how they made you feel. And that features heavily in something like this, in Red Coat. And as I say, the only time I've ever felt that I was onto something as big as this that was going to be as personal and for me a bit of a career jumping quality and ability and stuff on display was the Ultimates, and that was a long time ago. Not that I've been on autopilot since, but that was a huge leap for me, the Authority and the Ultimate. So this is in the same vein as that in terms of how I feel about it.
Okay.
Yeah. Issue ones, they're always tricky. I have a load of favorite issue ones I read when I was a kid. Like Brian, I in the mid 80s when DC was relaunching everything, like Superman and Flash, Justice League, you know, ultimately like Animal Man, like all those books, Shade the Changing Man. I remember like the ones that were like bigger were excited me because it just felt like substantial. And I got more story, I got to know the characters better. But writing first issues over the years, I've written a lot of first issues from Teen Titans to Aquaman to Green Lantern. And I just, the one thing that, and Justice Society, the one thing that I always try to do in the first issues and that I appreciated when I read great ones was that I just knew who the characters were and kind of like just, I knew who the characters were and I knew tonally what the book was. And I was captured by, you know, something in the story. It was pretty clean and straightforward, but and it had to be different. Like there's so many books that are like, you guys have all read superhero books. It's like a character X with power Y. And it's like, okay, they fight a villain. There's like, this could be Firestorm or it could be the Ray or it could be Star. If the story's got to be specifically tailored to that superhero, an Aquaman story I can't just remove Aquaman and put Green Lantern in the story and it's the same story. But I feel like there's some superhero books that just do that. And I'm always trying to make sure that the stories and the scenarios are specific to that character because that character has to go through that story. that's the whole point. It's the story and the emotional conflict within the character and the struggle they have is there's a reason that story's happening. That story is there to expose and explore the emotional content of the character. So when Aquaman walks into a seafood restaurant and is confronted by a blogger who says, you know, you can't be in here, you talk to fish, and like there's a whole conversation about how he's no one's favorite superhero. And that scene was really important because it was only a scene that Aquaman could deal with. And I think all superheroes or all books in themselves, they need to have these emotional stories are explored in the external, and they need to be unique. And that's the best number ones that I've ever read are that the story is exploring the character and vice versa. They're talking to each other. It's not just a hero gets powers and then a villain shows up and they fight each other. I've read so many of those where I could take the heroes and interchange them all. And, you know, those are never fun for me.
Fair enough. Jason?
I have two that came to mind that had big impacts on me. One was Ultimate X-Men number one, which I would have been maybe 13, 14 when that came out. And I read it digitally online. There was an online Marvel app, and I remember reading that issue, and that's the book that really once I read that issue, I went and I hunted down all the Ultimate X-Men books that were out at that time. I remember I bought like an eBay lot. I had my dad help me buy an eBay lot, but I still don't have Ultimate X-Men number one, like a physical copy of that book, but I have 2 to like 16, 17, 18. But that was a book that really got me into comics. Like that was when I really was like, I got to go to the comic store every week. And so that was like the catalyst to get me really loving comic books and love the collecting of comics and reading the stories and the artwork. And that's where I started to see like David Finch's art, and then found out that he was from my area. And that led to me eventually learning from him. And so that issue was kind of like a jumping off point. And then another one, actually it's one of Jeff's books. It was Blackest Night number one. And that was around the time when I was starting to really, like, I was like, I had set a goal, like, I want to create a comic book portfolio. And I remember that book came out, and I was living up in a small community up in Northern Ontario. And at the time, and I found a small little comic shop there, and they had it. And I had gotten the zero. I think there was a zero issue, wasn't there, as well?
Yeah, free comic.
And then the first issue, I bought both of them, and I read them, and I was just so blown away by the story. I wasn't a DC reader. I really didn't know who these characters really even were, but the way that Jeff laid them all out in that, I was learning, and it just opened me up to this new universe of characters. And Ivan's art was like, that's what I fell in love with his artwork. It was so good. And after that, I really started to dive into comic books hardcore, really wanted to hone my skills. And, you know, that eventually led me to reach out to David Finch and start to learn from him. So, you know, those were two number ones that I really had an impact on me and helped kind of pave my way to a career in comic books.
Yeah. I'm hoping that the April 3rd, there's people that are kind of new to comics, or maybe then, and they buy all three, and this affects them that same way, you know.
Yeah.
And
it's going to happen. Also, it'll happen. I'll say it. It'll happen.
Yeah.
I'm excited for that. I'm excited to have people like get inspired by it. And, you know, one of the things we've talked about is like, it is our dream to, like, my dream was always to write the Flash comic. That was my greatest dream, write the Flash comic. That's all I wanted to do, because the Flash was my favorite character. And ultimately I did do that. And I remember when I finished it, it was like, my dad was like, well, what's next? I'm like, I had no idea. But I'd done it, and I realized now that there is something to be said about having Ghost Machine, like, we're out there and showing people that DC and Marvel are not the only stop or the last stop. It's actually a stop for sure. People should, you know, if they love Spider-Man and Batman and stuff, do those characters. But the ultimate thing is to do your own stuff. And, you know, Image taught us that. And quite honestly, like, I'm happy that we're doing it now in this stage in our life and careers. Like, it's worked out for the very, very best.
Right.
But as Todd McFarlane told Eric Stevenson when he heard about us doing this, like, what took him so long? Meaning, what took next generation to just kind of band together and go do this and go for it, you know? I love that quote. I kind of want to put that quote in our office, like, what took them so long? Because it is true. Like, yeah, we got to go for it. But I'm really glad we're going for it now with the team we've got.
I think it's awesome, because for me, I'm later on in my life, but I got into comic books late in the game. So as a new reader, just as that the newest reader of the bullpen and of the group, like this gets me all teary-eyed, because like for what you guys are doing in the industry to make it easier to break in to comics is huge, not only for my generation, but like for future generations. Like comics played a huge impact in like helping my daughter read. She had reading problems. And I was like, well, let's try graphic novels. And then I found a huge comic book community and Canon and others that kind of like helped pave the way for me to figure out like how to do stuff. So for you doing that on that level and bringing in new readers, just, you know, I get a little emotional about it. So I'm all in. I'm so stoked for you guys and to build out this lasting legacy. So I think it's great.
Thanks so much. That's really nice. We're really, I will say, we're really trying to make sure that the books are worth everyone's time.
They absolutely are. I mean, the one thing that your company has been saying since day one, since we were at New York Comic Con last year, walking into that panel, it's characters first. And that carries through every single book that I picked up from Ghost Machine. And I know the rest of the bullpen has too, that we know when we pick that up, it's characters, it's heart, it's story driven. It is everything that we have been looking for as comic readers. That when we talk about those classic moments in the past, it's right here in the present, and it's going to be here in the future for what you're doing with Redcoat, Rook Exodus, and Geiger, just starting the next wave of what's going to be comics' next big line. I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, there's no question about it. And like I said before in the beginning of this episode, and I'm going to scream it again, March 11th is final order cutoff date. You need to have these issues, and I would say get at least two issues of these, because you're definitely going to want to make sure you have a backup one, because they're going to be so valuable. They're just from a personal level that you are going to make sure you don't want to ever lose it. You want to make sure you have multiple copies of these issues ordered, and definitely spread the word about this to any single comic book fan yet, you know, because if they don't have these issues in their possession on April 3rd, Ghost Machine Day, they're doing something very wrong. Trust me, this will be worth your time. This will be worth your money. You're not going to be let down. And this is going to be the start of the next big thing. Guaranteed. Gentlemen, thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to us today. We definitely have to talk after the issues come out.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you guys. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you to the bullpen, Tom, Matt, and Marty. My name is Ken M. And thank you, the listener, for listening to another edition of Turn a Page. And we'll end it as we always do. When you're at a comic shop and you have a great issue in your hand, such as Redcoat, Rook Exodus, Geiger, I get too excited. See, that's how I mess up my words. And you see somebody struggling to pick up an issue, hand yours off to them. Tell them turn a page. We'll see you next time.
It's such a waste of time, swiping left and swiping right on people you could know. Does anyone who's worth a damn be worth way more than a picture could ever show? You could find the right light, find the right angle, and never find your soul. And it can feel like a losing battle, and this plot is full of holes. This modern way of finding love just makes me feel so alone. And I can't be the only one sick of staring at my phone. So look up, talk to me. A better way to spend our energy. Just look up, talk to me. We don't have to blow the moon on the open sea. Don't know that I believe in the old time fable. Everyone has just one true love. All I know is you're across this table, and you're all I'm thinking of. So look up, talk to me. A better way to spend our energy. Just look up, talk to me. We don't have to float alone on the open sea. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Talk to me. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Talk to me. It's such a waste of time, swiping left and swiping right on people you could know.
Whoa, oh.